Now, you've probably heard the title. It's the book that everyone's talking about, including narrator Sherry Baines, who nominated it as one of the books of her life a couple of weeks ago. It won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize, the highest accolade in American literature, and it's been on the international bestseller list ever since. I'm talking about All the Light We Cannot See by American author Anthony Doerr. But here's the thing. I tend to give books with fictional blind characters a miss, particularly if the author is sighted. It's always the same old clichés. A stricken victim, usually female, or a hero with sensory superpowers, usually male. And invariably, they're all completely sightless, unlike the majority of real blind people. So, when I first heard that All the Light We Cannot See featured a young, blind French girl stranded in war-torn France, I thought, here we go again, it's bound to be mawkish. What changed my mind was the enthusiasm with which even those who know my views on blind fiction greeted the book. And then the Bloomsbury Book Group, who appeared on this show a couple of months ago, and which includes several VI members, emailed to tell me that All the Light We Cannot See was the most unanimously popular title they'd ever chosen. I knew my time had come to read it. Set in France and Germany before and during the Second World War, the story follows the fates of Marie Laure, a blind Parisian girl, and Werner, an orphan from the mining district near Essen. Both are motherless. Werner and his sister Uta are cared for by a French nun at a children's home. Marie Laure lives with her beloved and doting papa, who is a locksmith at the Paris Museum of Natural History.
At home in the evenings, her father stows their shoes in the same cubby, hangs their coats on the same hooks. Marie Laure crosses 6 evenly spaced friction strips on the kitchen tiles to reach the table. She follows a strand of twine he's threaded from the table to the toilet. He serves dinner on a round plate and describes the locations of different foods by the hands of a clock. Potatoes at 6 o'clock, ma chérie. Mushrooms at 3. Then he lights a cigarette and goes to work on his miniatures at a workbench in the corner of the kitchen. He's building a scale model of their entire neighbourhood. The tall windowed houses, the rain gutters, the laverie and boulangerie, and the little place at the end of the street with its 4 benches and 10 trees. On warm nights, Marie Laure opens her bedroom window and listens to the evening as it settles over the balconies and gables and chimneys, languid and peaceful. Until the real neighbourhood and the miniature one get mixed up in her mind. Tuesdays, the museum is closed. Marie Laure and her father sleep in. They drink coffee thick with sugar. They walk to the Pantheon or to a flower market along the Seine. Every so often they visit the bookshop. He hands her a dictionary, a journal, a magazine full of photographs. How many pages, Marie Laure? She runs a nail along the edge. 52? 705? 139? He sweeps her hair back from her ears. He swings her above his head. He says she is his émerveillement. He says he will never leave her. Not in a million years.
The museum houses a supposedly cursed diamond known as the Sea of Flames. When the Nazis invade Paris, the diamond is entrusted to Marie Laure's father. They flee to the Normandy town of Saint-Malo, where, as in Paris, her father builds Marie Laure a model of the surrounding area so that she can find her way around. Meanwhile, Werner, living in dire poverty, has discovered an old radio that he painstakingly repairs.
Static. Static. He's about to hand the earphone to Uta when, clear and unblemished, about halfway down the coil, he hears the quick, drastic strikes of a bow dashing across the strings of a violin. He tries to hold the pin perfectly still. A second violin joins the first. Yuta drags herself closer. She watches her brother with outsized eyes. A piano chases the violins, then woodwinds. The strings sprint, woodwinds fluttering behind. More instruments join in. Flutes, harps. The song races, seems to loop back over itself. Verna? Yuta whispers. He blinks. He has to swallow back tears. The parlour looks the same as it always has. Two cribs beneath two Latin crosses. Dust floating in the open mouth of the stove. A dozen layers of paint peeling off the baseboards. A needlepoint of Frau Elena's snowy Alsatian village above the sink. Yet now there is music. As if inside Werner's head, an infinitesimal orchestra has stirred to life. The room seems to fall into a slow spin. His sister says his name more urgently, and he presses the earphone to her ear. Music, she says. He holds the pin as stock still as he can. The signal is weak enough that though the earphone is 6 inches away, he can't hear any trace of the song. But he watches his sister's face, motionless except for her eyelids. And in the kitchen, Frau Elena holds her flower-whitened hands in the air and cocks her head, studying Werner. And two older boys rush in and stop, sensing some change in the air. And the little radio, with its four terminals and trailing aerial, sits motionless on the floor between them all, like a miracle.
Not only does the radio offer them a window on the world beyond their poverty, it provides Werner with a way out. His talent for repairing radios is spotted, and he is sent to an elite but brutal military academy to be trained as a son of the Third Reich. Soon he's working on radio tracking devices to help the German war effort. Meanwhile, a German gem specialist has got wind of the Sea of Flames and has started a relentless search to track it down. The opening chapters are set in 1944. St Malo is under siege following the D-Day landings, and so the reader knows that the three strands of the story have come together, but not how or what will happen next. The imminent threat of death and the youth and vulnerability of Mary Law and the gentle Werner compel the reader to turn the pages to find out what fate awaits them. Their backstories have an almost fairy tale quality, told as they are in short alternating chapters between longer passages about the progress of the siege. It's a world of good talismans and bad omens, of wicked souls and benevolent ones, in which the young heroes are innocents abroad. Mary Law's imagination is fired by her ability to read Braille. She explores the world via the pages of Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Charles Darwin's Voyages of the Beagle. Werner's exploration is more mathematical, but, like Mary Law, he discovers a love of learning that transcends the limits that life has put on him. A passion offering a loom on which to spin his dreams, as Dürer so elegantly puts it. The book is extremely well researched and full of insight. The characters are beautifully drawn and the dialogue drives the story forward, often sounding like snatches of radio broadcasts that Werner might have tuned into. I found the reaction to 6-year-old Mary Law's sight loss particularly resonant.
Congenital cataracts. Bilateral. Irreparable. Can you see this? Ask the doctors. Can you see this? Mary Law will not see anything for the rest of her life. Spaces she once knew as familiar, the four-room flat she shares with her father, the little tree-lined square at the end of their street, have become labyrinths, bristling with hazards. Drawers are never where they should be. The toilet's an abyss. A glass of water is too near, too far. Her fingers too big, always too big. What is blindness? Where there should be a wall, her hands find nothing. Where there should be nothing, a table leg gouges her shin. Cars growl in the streets, leaves whisper in the sky. Blood rustles through her inner ears. In the stairwell, in the kitchen, even beside her bed, grown-up voices speak of despair. Poor child. Poor Monsieur Leblanc. Hasn't had an easy road, you know. His father dead in the war, his wife dead in childbirth. And now this. Like they're cursed. Look at her. Look at him. Ought to send her away. Those are months of bruises and wretchedness. Rooms pitching like sailboats. Half-open doors striking Marie-Laure's face. Her only sanctuary is in bed, the hem of her quilt at her chin, while her father smokes another cigarette in the chair beside her, whittling away at one of his tiny models, his little hammer going tap, 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 his little square of sandpaper making a rhythmic, soothing rasp. The despair doesn't last. Marie-Laure is too young, and her father is too patient. There are, he assures her, no such things as curses. There is luck, maybe, bad or good. A slight inclination of each day towards success or failure. But no curses.
I was hooked from beginning to end. Dürr is a masterful storyteller. And although the book meanders a bit in its middle section, as did the Second World War, it remained a page-turner. The only thing that spoilt it for me was the writing style. Although I got used to the dramatic present tense and the overuse of adjectives and adverbs, the modern Americanisms that litter the story stood at odds with a book set in wartime Europe. Also, it didn't help that the narrator struggled with some of the longer words and names. These, however, are minor grumbles. As entertainment, All the Light We Cannot See is one of the best books I've read this year. At 17 hours long, it's perfect for a long journey or a holiday read. And although it deals with some of the more harrowing aspects of war, it doesn't go in for gratuitous descriptions, making it suitable for older teenagers and adults alike. In many ways, it reminded me of Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier. Both shared the desire to create something beautiful in a time of war. Both are ultimately very moving, thought-provoking stories that have stayed with me a long time after I've read them. And while Marie-Laure is a victim of blindness who often has to rely on others for help, she is also determined, independent-minded, and alive to her surroundings. Notwithstanding any other inaccuracies in the book, Anthony Dürr has succeeded in creating a realistic and compelling blind character in a story with mass appeal. For that alone, he deserves the Pulitzer Prize he won in 2015 and every enthusiastic review that he receives. All the Light We Cannot See, read by Julie Teal, is available as TB22201. Do you have a book you think would expand my reading horizons, or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.